Hey guys, Will here. No quote this week, just throwing you right into episode 300. Huge word of thank you to everybody that has helped me make it this far, from co-hosts to contributors to guests to fans to Patreon supporters to literally anybody who's ever had any involvement whatsoever with the show. So thank you very much. This week, we're going to go a little timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly on you guys. Turns out we just found this abandoned time machine laying around. So get ready as we bounce back and forth through Game of Thrones time and kind of see where things lead us. First up, we're going to dive into the present with Danny, the current lead designer for the game. Then we're jumping forward to the future for some spoiler talk. And then we're going to dive far into the past for something a lot of current listeners may not realize we did, which was actually to interview George R.R. Martin himself on this show the very first weekend we started recording. So stay tuned, enjoy the show. And go check out our YouTube page for what I think is a pretty hilarious automated transcription of the George R.R. Martin interview if you need a laugh. Thanks, and here's to 300 more. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Chimps and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to do the same in the second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to GRRM for his amazing novels, FFG for this fantastic game, Card Game DB for getting us a start, and you, our loyal listeners, for sticking through thick and thin. Check us out on our website, Facebook, or Twitter, or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com, and rate us on iTunes. This CC licensed music is Town Function by Spinoza. Okay, guys, well, here we go with part one of episode 300. We're going to have this divided into thirds, and this is the first third. So up first, of course, myself, Will, Tommy rejoining us from the depths of the frozen wasteland to the north, i.e. Chicago, for the first time in a couple months, I think, right?
Yeah, it feels like it. Back from the never never, as Dresden would say, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I haven't read the Dresden stuff in a while. I need to. I'm behind. But far more important than that is our third host or co-host or interviewee, however you want to phrase that. And that is FFG or Asmodee North America's very own Danny Schaefer.
So, hey guys.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I guess there's, you know, a lot to talk about, but we're going to try to just hit some salient points here in about half an hour or so for this segment. I'm sure listeners are going to wish we had a whole lot more time than that. But speaking of, for listeners that maybe are not too familiar with the face, the brain, the man behind the game at the moment. Danny, would you be kind enough to give us a little bit of an interview of, you know, kind of how you got into gaming in general? Did you get into Game of Thrones through the books or show and then FFG, or FFG first and then then the world from there, or, you know, how did all that stuff kind of play out?
Well, I got into gaming first for sure. I'd always played games as a kid, and as I got older, I started to play a lot more of newer board games and got into games like Magic and stuff like that. And my introduction to Game of Thrones really actually came after I got into LCG, and actually after I started FFG even. I was hired on sort of generally as part of the LCG department, and then they decided that Thrones was where they wanted to have me, and I got really into it at that point and got into the books and the show and everything from there.
Okay. Well, with gaming, you know, were you a board gamer? Were you into other competitive card games? What's kind of your favorite flavor?
Yeah, I like other competitive card games for sure. You know, I played Magic, obviously really into Thrones now. I played a bit of Netrunner, played Conquest back when that was a thing. So, yeah, competitive card games has always sort of been the aspect of games that I've been most into. But I also play a lot of, you know, just general board games, play a lot of FFG stuff, things like Arkham Horror and Eldritch Horror and those type of games. So yeah, I sort of dabble in a bit of everything, but mostly stick to the competitive card games.
I think you're on record saying that the plots are one of your favorite things about Game of Thrones, and that it's one of the things that differentiated Thrones for you from the other games you were familiar with. What, aside from the plots, since you've gotten into design, has been your most favorite aspect of Game of Thrones to design on?
Ooh, that's a good question. Obviously, as you mentioned, plots are really fun, really cool. I guess what I really like is designing the unique characters, honestly. Just trying to start from that place of these really like well-built, fleshed-out characters from the source material, and trying to figure out how to distill that down into a really, you know, a single text box of card ability, and try and come up with something cool that really captures that character and what they're all about. And it's fun to play.
Nice.
That works out well for your Roberts and your Renleys and such that are fleshed out really well in the books. But what about some of these others that we wind up seeing in the game that have been cropping up? For instance, Garland Tyrell was recently spoiled that, you know, only has a couple appearances in the books and nothing really from his point of view now the name's escaping me, the Lannister lady that gives everyone 3 gold. You know, some of these big characters, do you go back in and try to delve into what there is that exists for them, or do they wind up being a little more, I think it's bottom-up design, right, where you just go ahead and design a card and then say, hey, what name can fit here?
Sure. Yeah, it depends on the character and how much there is to work with, really. Like with Garland Tyrell, I think we get enough of him in the books. We know that he's, you know, this great knight, and he's known for his chivalry and also for being, you know, very very strong in battle. So we can sort of extrapolate a bit from that and give him a nice ability that works in challenges and works with knights, and that sort of makes sense. But yeah, with some of like the really minor characters, you're right that it becomes much more of a bottom-up type thing where we don't really have enough about them to get something super thematic. So it's just, what does the faction need? What would be a cool effect to put on a unique character that would go well in the faction for the game, but doesn't necessarily tie that closely to the actual source material?
Okay. Well, let's see. I know that you kind of joined up partway through things and kind of the reins were handed over to you. I'm trying to recall. Was it the Night's Watch box? Was that about the time period? Was it before that?
Yeah, I'd say Night's Watch was about when I was really in sort of driving the game. I sort of started, apprenticing with Nate, if you will, with like the first cycle in the Stark box, and gradually he would hand over more and more of the responsibilities to me. But yeah, around second cycle, Night's Watch box is when I really sort of took the reins.
Gotcha. Were you involved in like internal testing or anything, even if you weren't officially, you know, even apprenticing on like the core set in the initial second ed development? Or did you not join into it at all until after that had already kind of been ironed out?
I started right after we sort of wrapped up the core set. So I didn't quite get in on the ground floor there, but everything from the first cycle onwards I was involved in playtesting and things like that.
So being involved so early front on, I'm sure that you picked up a lot from Nate in terms of his design process, the way that he looks at cards and the meta at large and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. If you had to pinpoint one thing that differentiated your design style from Nate's, what would you call that?
That's an interesting question, because you're right that I did learn a lot from Nate and really adapted a lot of his philosophies. I think one place where we're different, and it's sort of obvious when you think about it, is that Nate, of course, has been playing the game for, you know, since its inception, has been designing it for 10 years or about that long, I guess. And he really likes to call back to older cards and older designs and he likes the game and he likes to
nostalgia.
Go back. Yeah, nostalgia. Exactly. And I like that a little bit, but I'm always looking to also try new things and see where we can take the game that it hasn't been before. And, you know, obviously, you know, Nate also wants to push the boundaries a little bit, but I think that nostalgia is a difference between us for sure.
With that context in mind, did you do research on 1.0 cards or CCG era cards just so that you had that frame of reference, or did you try to keep those fresh eyes as much as you could?
I did a bit of research for sure. Like I'm now familiar with a lot of the highly played cards from first edition, but I certainly don't have anything close to Nate's knowledge of it. And every so often I will like design a card and then Nate will look at it and say, oh, it's like a reprint of that card from the CCG. And I'll be like, oh, so it is. I didn't realize that. So yeah, I do like to think that I keep things fresh a little bit.
Nice.
Hey, great minds think alike, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, kind of related to that type of thing. I mean, we haven't had too many changeovers in lead designers, you know, since the initial game launched back in 2002, but we've had some. And I feel like each time there has been a little bit of a, shall we say, rules hiccup, maybe, is kind of the way to look at it. Like just different brains kind of look at trying to phrase stuff, even if they're both wanting the same type of effect, look at phrasing it a little differently. Is that something you worry about? Do you go back and study older cards and phrasing and like established stuff to try to fit a set established
like template
format?
Continuity or something?
Yeah.
And I do try to be pretty careful about that, about making sure that we're phrasing things and templating things consistently throughout the game. And it's not always going to end up being exactly the same. You have a new effect that hasn't been done before, and you just try to find the closest analog you can in the previous card. But yeah, it's something I'm really aware of. And the other side of that is, of course, Nate, even though he's got other projects going on now, he's still involved in the game. And he's still looking at all the cards before they go out. So we both sort of have our eyes on it and try to make sure that things are staying consistent and we're keeping that continuity between the older cards and the newer ones.
It certainly felt that way.
Yeah, I have not noticed any sort of kind of radical shift in anything as the cards you've taken the lead on have dropped on us. So I think that's good. I think that definitely that consistency is good for the game and the players and keeping FAQs as small as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, so. I think I'm... Oh, go right ahead, Dean.
I was going to say, yeah, that's definitely something we aim for. I know that first edition eventually got a very large FAQ and errata list, and obviously it's going to happen eventually if this game goes on long enough, but we're going to try and strive to keep it a lot smaller than that.
If this game goes on long enough, Danny, you got to fill me with more hope and certainty than that.
When this game inevitably goes on long enough.
There you go. Thank you.
Continues on for decades to come.
Exactly. So I'm kind of curious then, thinking about design and mechanics, and especially I'm kind of curious about this as someone who has kind of come in from other games and from someone who was not there from the absolute, you know, ground up. I'm sure you're very aware of several of the design decisions kind of made about the relaunch into second edition. So as someone who's kind of come in from outside there, you know, which of those do you think have really kind of nailed it and succeeded? And flip side, you know, without throwing Nate under the bus or anything, but, you know, is there anything that maybe didn't work out quite as well as anticipated, or, you know, worked in the core, but then as more cards came, you know, wound up needing to be tweaked or that sort of thing?
Yeah, so there are, I think most of the things we were going for in second edition have been reasonably successful, but there, of course, have been bumps in the road as we've worked through them. So, the focus on the sort of expensive unique characters is a good example, I think, where one of our aims was to have these big iconic characters like Tywin and Ned and, you know, the Queen of Thorns and people like that be sort of at the center of the game and a big focal point around which the game could revolve. And we definitely met the aim of having them be important. Now, early on in particular, that sort of had some weird effects on the metagame, where they almost took on too much importance and it was too hard to deal with them, and their sort of games were starting to get warped around who got their big uniques out fastest and most protected and whatnot. So we sort of had to put some answers in the card pool, change some things around to smooth it out a bit. But in the end, I think, you know, we're at a place now where those characters are still good, but maybe not as overwhelming, not as swingy. So that's a good example of, I think, what we've been able to do in second edition.
Well, speaking of smoothing things out, that does kind of pull me back to one of the main themes I felt like in this third cycle is smoothing out that econ curve. Is that one of those tools you were thinking of? Is this just a kind of a different natural progression of things?
Yeah, smoothing out the econ was definitely a big goal here. You know, again, that's something that we did a pretty good job in the core and early on, but I feel like we didn't get it quite right. We wanted, you know, econ to matter more. We wanted more, you know, economy is limited. Economy, it's hard to just explode with a bunch of gold right at the start of the game or anything like that. But we maybe pulled back a little bit too much and made it too hard to get economy for a lot of factions. And so then when the factions that could get good economy became very strong, like Lannister was early on, and, you know, the high gold plots became really, really powerful, almost necessary inclusions in the plot deck. So we wanted to pull back on that a little bit to where the economy is still important. You still have to think about it. You're not just guaranteed to have all the gold you need. But it's a little more open. There's a little more flexibility and a little more ability to get the gold you need without pigeoning yourself into very specific cards.
So I'd be remiss to not ask, since we're talking about economy and limiting economy especially, has there been discussion about potential other drawbacks other than limited, where you're taking an apparent downside to get the economy that you need, but really suffering some consequence?
There has been, for sure. We've talked about a lot of things, and non-limited economy has definitely come up. And we did try it. We tried a very conservative approach to non-limited economy in the second cycle, where we had the cards like, you know, Bail and Solar and Bear Island and things like that, where they're you don't have the limited keyword, but you're getting much less efficient return in your economy. And a lot of them, you know, some of them are pretty good and some of them didn't work out as well. And I think in the future, we'll look at that again and see if we can push some more non-limited options in different ways with different drawbacks.
Nice. That's exciting. So one more hard-hitting question I'll follow up with is, from a metagame perspective, when you guys talk with the guys from Organized Play and with the developers, have there been any really, really legitimate strong considerations for things going onto a restricted list at any point?
There have been at certain points. I'll say that right now, not so much. Right now, we're feeling pretty good about where the metagame is. There's been a big increase in diversity recently, but we definitely talked about it earlier on in the game's life when there was a lot less diversity, of course, when certain strategies and factions were pretty dominant and other ones were pretty weak. And it's something we'll definitely be revisiting again as time goes on and as the metagame continues to shift. And yeah, if we see the need, we'll certainly do it.
Yeah, I definitely thought it would be more retrospective than current. It feels like a really healthy meta right now.
I agree. I really like where the game is at the moment.
Awesome. Glad to hear it.
Well, yeah. Well, speaking of that and the environment and everything, I'm curious because I know everything is kind of designed and tested and tweaked so far in advance to account for, you know, art design, printing, shipping, all that. That makes hitting meta predictions on exactly where the actual game competitive or otherwise is going to be, faction strengths, deck archetypes, and so on, a very shifting target. Has there been anything, say, in the, you know, since the start of the year or anything like that, that has just really jumped out and as, whoa, we didn't see that coming? And that's not even necessarily a bad thing. You know, it could be a good, whoa, we didn't think, you know, players were going to put together this sort of thing, cough, Viper combo decks, or, you know, whatever that might be.
Yeah, that would be the example that I was thinking of, honestly. We didn't think Viper combo decks would quite be there yet. But it's cool to see. It's cool to see people pushing the boundaries in unexpected ways. And of course, when we designed the cards to go in that deck, we knew that, you know, the You Murdered Her Children is a combo card. We know that's how people are going to try to use it. So, yeah, that one definitely jumped out. Trying to think if there are any others. There are always decks that surprise you with how well they perform. Like, you know, I'm not surprised at all that there's a Night's Watch Builder deck out there. Like, we knew that we were seeding that deck. I'm a little surprised that it's been as good as it has been, but we knew it would be good, so it's not like too surprising. But yeah, again, it's always cool to see players jump on ideas that we didn't know that they were, you know, quite as ready and as complete as they actually are, and it's fun to watch. Yeah.
Mommy, you got anything? If not, I've got another one to jump in with.
Well, I suppose the natural question to follow up with here is, given the discussion of the metagame and understanding that it's quite balanced at the moment and real healthy, and there being a lot of options out there, if you had to go to a competitive tournament, a la Gen Con, what would be your deck of choice that you'd go with?
Oh, that's a good question. It's always like kind of hard to answer from my perspective, just because I'm always, you know, playtesting and playing with cards, you know, in the metagame a year from now. So it's hard for me sometimes to pull back into the what the current metagame looks like. I do like the I do tend to go for more controlling decks, more like slower, grindier decks. So I like I've been liking Martell lately for that reason, but I think they're not quite Martell control. I don't think is quite tier one, although Secret Schemes helps a lot. I've really been enjoying playing with that card. So I might bring something like that.
Yes.
Yeah, that card's really strong.
And maybe they're a closer away.
Yeah. I think they're. I think they're pretty close. I think they're pretty close. So I might. I might play that. You know, I'd almost say Targ Burn, although I think it's almost too much on people's radar. You don't really want to come in with a deck that everyone knows is going to be the best deck, or thinks is going to be the best deck at least. But if it were a little more under the radar, I might go that direction.
Sure.
Well, related to that, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What's your prediction for what takes Gen Con down? What wins?
Let's see.
You know what? Even better. What wins Joust and what wins Melee? Yeah, Melee. I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, geez. Okay, let's see. I think wild, unfounded opinions. I think that Tyrell Crossing is going to win Melee. It seems like a good Melee deck.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Joust, I think something a little unexpected will take Joust. Maybe I think Night's Watch might take Joust.
Like builders.
Yeah, I
like
think kind of thing. A defensive deck, but maybe with a little twist that we haven't seen before. That'd be my guess.
Okay.
Cool.
There you go, listeners. Go out there and prove Danny right
or wrong.
Whatever your preference might be.
So not assuming that either of your picks there have any influence on what you called out. From the source material, mm-hmm. is there a faction that kind of has your preference or pulls your heartstrings a little more than the others?
Oh, just like from the books. I'd say my favorites in the books are I like Tyrell. I like their style. I like Marjorie and the Queen of Thorns and all their scheming and being a little less overt about it than the Lannisters, but they still have schemes cooking. They're one of my favorites for sure. I like Stark too. Arya is one of my favorite characters, and I enjoy the Starks as well.
Well, speaking of favorites, I've been sitting here kind of thinking about this one since I heard you had a little bit of a background of Magic, and that Tommy mentioned that plots were one of your favorite things about Game of Thrones, because that's something I've always really hyped up to people when I'm trying to get them to play Game of Thrones. Hey, have you played Magic before? Well, you know what? Mana Screw is not really a thing. You got gold on your plots, whatever it might be. You can Wrath of God at will of Valor Morghulis, that sort of thing. So the question is, what is your favorite plot? And if it's not Valor Morghulis, I'm going to be a little sad, but I'll eventually forgive you.
I do like Valor Morghulis. I also I like the recently spoiled Valor Doharis. Not out yet, but I'm really excited for that to hit the metagame. I think it does. I think it's going to do really cool things.
I agree. This is not something you necessarily have to commit to, but that scene, that plot did surprise me, with it coming out of or at least being very similar to the draft only right. stuff. In my mind, I kind of had it in my head that the draft only stuff was kind of a closed door, and that is all we would see of it. Does this mean that there is the possibility of seeing some of that other stuff, you know, agendas or what have you, eventually make it into the game at large, or is this probably just a one-time thing?
You know, it's not something we were planning on when we made the draft-only cards. We had that idea, as you mentioned, that it would be a self-contained thing. These would be good for the draft environment, but no plans with them for the future. But, you know, we saw how popular the Pale Mayor was in draft and how there were things going on in the constructed metagame that it seemed like could really be helped by that type of card, like a plot that has a cannot be saved clause that sort of, you know, doesn't completely wipe your board, but can punish you for trying to go all in on, you know, saves and big characters and keep things manageable in that kind of way. So again, we didn't design it with that in mind when we were doing the draft, but it's a door we leave open. And if there's another draft only card that we look at and say, you know what, this would be great to have constructed, then yeah, we're open to doing it again.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you asked the question, Will, because when I read that card being spoiled, the first thing that crossed my mind is it looked at like draft or other potentially alternate formats that people might be doing out there that you guys become aware of? Does that look to you as almost a free playtesting impact session where you can just evaluate things and say, without any sort of commitments or otherwise, how do players like this? What does it impact? That kind of thing.
Kind of. I mean, again, we go into it with our number one goal is just to make the draft environment as fun as possible and as interesting as possible as a standalone thing. But it is kind of cool to be able to see cards in different contexts and try out some new designs and see what they look like and see how they play. And again, it can really give us some inspirations that we can take into our future designs, which is really cool.
Right on.
Well, I know we're getting close to the end of our time here at the moment, but you know, I'm kind of curious if our discussions here have brought up any interesting anecdotes or a fun behind-the-scenes story about the time that you crushed Nate mercilessly and he was crying into his beer at the FFG Event Center, or, you know, whatever it might be. You know, do you have any other thoughts bouncing around in your head that you're just desperate to get out to the community at large?
Oh, you know, I might have some good...
Wow, there's a pause there. Was that story about Nate true?
Nate is a very interesting guy to play Melee with. I'll say that.
Oh, I don't think I've ever gotten to play Melee with him. That sounds like a blast.
It's really
fun. I can't believe I've never done that.
Yeah, you should try it sometime.
Needs to happen.
Yeah, Nate French has made some ironclad guarantees to his opponents.
Did they sink about like ironclad boats do?
Yeah, about like that.
Well, Lannister is his favorite house.
Nate also has built some interesting decks for Melees too. Like I've never really seen a Stark Reigns of Castamir deck other than out of Nate French. But
that sounds interesting.
For Melee.
That
really surprises me. Huh. Well, that actually does bring to mind an interesting question, because Melee, you know, does tend to get kind of short shrift in the community and discussion and such. And I'm a little curious, because it does sound like you guys are playing some behind the scenes. You know, what sort of Melee play style do you have? I don't know if you read the player articles that the marketing folks wind up soliciting and putting up on the site. So I don't know if you saw my archetypes that I dreamed up or not.
Yeah, I did read it. I can't remember the names of all the archetypes offhand. Maybe you can refresh my memory briefly.
In the quick nutshell, Cersei is the brittle, win by turn two or go home. Just speed rush. Brienne is a little more defensive, makes those ironclad deals, and they are truly ironclad. She will stick with them 100%. Then you've got the Queen of Thorns, who really enjoys the social aspect, the talking back and forth, but everything is a matter of expediency.
Mm-hmm.
She's very willing to make a deal, but also very willing to make a deal. And last but not least is Chella. And it turns out some people just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah, I think I'm probably closest to a Brienne out of those. I like, I don't like the game to be over too quick, but I do like the deal making, and I like to sort of bide my time and then and strike when I'm ready. And I am, I like to think I'm a player of my word. I usually don't break deals without having a very, very good reason.
Oh, that almost sounds like you're delving into
Queen of Thorns, you think? Oh, okay. I almost like that better.
Maybe. I don't know. I might need to see you play a game, but you know, you already said Tyrell is probably your favorite faction.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think you're probably right. I think I started that question thinking I was a Brienne, and I talked myself into the Queen of Thorns by the end of it.
Perfect.
Well,
good man. That's
Brienne
my
is the Tyrell character, no?
She is these days.
I'm
want to preface
the man
this.
Out. I'm trying to give the man an out.
I'm going to say that I have no prior knowledge, and Danny will probably not be able to say anything really about it, but I would be very surprised if we don't also see a Stark Brienne at some point. Now I've put that worm in Danny's head.
I like that silence.
Well, okay, speaking of kind of spoilerific-y stuff, I know listeners are kind of itching to get to some stuff because I've been teasing that we were going to have some interesting news and a couple scoops during episode 300. So, you know, with our time running quickly to a close for this segment, I'm just going to really throw it over there to Danny. However he would like to present it, he has a raven with some very important news, as I understand it.
I do. I can't go into too much detail, but I can tell you a little bit about the next deluxe expansion after House of Thorns. It is going to be titled The Sands of Dorne, and based on that title, I suppose you can guess that it's going to focus on House Martell.
Ooh,
yeah.
Tasty. Yeah, I like it.
I'm very excited about it.
Man, cards can never come fast enough for months. Well, I'll just let the listeners kind of bask in the glow that will be the burning sands of Dorne here as they think about what that might mean.
Well, that was corny.
I know.
We really,
you know, you can't expect...
really scared the sun here.
Oh, jeez. You can't expect everything to be all sunshine and roses.
Oh, boy.
See, yeah. See, now we're even mixing house metaphors. It's great.
Those are the next two.
So.
Well, speaking of great, I want to throw out a great big thanks to Danny for being kind enough to carve out a little bit of time in his very busy schedule to jump on here for an interview for the show. Thank you, sir. I think it's been a blast from my point of view, and I think the listeners will enjoy it as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. And I know, well, at least the last time I made it to Gen Con, I didn't last year, FFG was kind of divvying up which employees were going to Gen Con and not. Is that still the case? Will you be there?
It is still the case. So this year, Nate is going to actually be going as the official head of the Game of Thrones tournament. But I am hoping that I'll be able to make it down there on my own, just as a civilian. And if I do, I'm sure I will drop by and see what's going on at the Thrones tournament.
Okay.
Well,
sweet
so
deal.
Then
well,
probably be do some drinks then.
yeah, I think I'd be open to that.
Can treat you for sure. Okay, guys, welcome back to the second portion of episode 300 of The White Book. This time, we're changing up the co-hosts a little bit so we can bring you another segment, a segment that I think many of our listeners are desperately waiting to hear more about, and that is spoilers, or spoilers, or previews, or whatever you want to call it. But joining me, Will, I also have...
Konnichiwa, bitches!
Well, I was going to say Joy and Aaron, the triumphant return of Kyle, but I think listeners definitely know Kyle's here.
I'm going to need a minute.
It's entirely possible second edition players have no idea what that is either and are just really fucking confused.
I at least did the core set. That was definitely out before my like 75 episode hiatus.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
75 episodes? I guess it was.
It was a lot.
It's more than 75 episodes.
I was on episode 200.
On the night shift? I mean...
2.5 years?
We can roughly look at every 50 episodes is a year.
222 was the big, like, how do you deck build in second edition? So, like, we did core set obviously before that, and that was at least, like, fucking 2 months of episodes.
I definitely was on episode 200. I'm going to call that, and some a-hole is going to go look up and be like, no, you weren't, but whatever.
No one's looking it up.
Facts don't matter.
It's a real pain to go look up old stuff from 200.
Wama will look it up.
Wama just knows. Wama has little tick marks every time we're wrong in some chart on his wall. By the way, here's where you messed up this time. In episode 196, you said a second edition of the game would never have a card that does this exact thing, and here it is. And it's like, motherfucker. When you write, you write, Wama. When you write.
Okay, so tell you what, we've got previews. And I think this will dovetail really nicely to our previous segment where Danny let us know the name and the faction of the next box, which is going to be a Martell box. And hey, what do you know? We have Martell spoilers.
Are these box cards?
No. Unfortunately, they are not not from the box. They're from the tail end of this cycle. I think it's next pack, final pack. I forget. Their cards number 115 and 116. That's last pack.
That's last pack, yeah. That's the pack after Gen Con that should be out for Worlds.
So we're a little not super ahead.
So, looks like House Martell's going to be pretty playable for Worlds.
Yeah. I mean, I think they've been getting a lot of tools lately, and it looks like they keep getting tools. So, you know, because I know certain co-hosts, most noticeably Kyle, are unlikely to have these cards actually in front of them while we do this bit. So I'm just going to go ahead and read them both real quick.
No, one at a time.
Okay, one at a time. Well, let's start with the character then, because characters are cooler. We've got the Dornish Spy. She is a non-unique, non-loyal Martell character. 3 cost, 3 strength, military and intrigue icons. She has the spy trait and ambush 4. And then the reaction after Dornish Spy enters play, choose a character. Until the end of the phase, that character loses a challenge icon of your choice.
Oh, okay. So what do you think of her, Will?
You know, I guess kind of like in a vacuum, I kind of like it. Like I love her just base cost strength icon ratio. I think that that's the sort of thing that's going to be really handy here in second edition, even with First Snow floating around. I feel like, gosh, I want Martell to have more icon control, but part of me kind of worries about the Dornish Spy. Just 4 ambush is pretty expensive when I'm looking at wanting to kind of combo her with some of these other effects that trigger off of a character having 1 or less icons, especially what's the one that bounces somebody to hand that's ambush 5?
Prince's Path.
Yeah. No, not the location, the other character.
Oh, the one in the box?
Yes.
Southron Messenger?
Yes.
Wow. Fuck it. Like, you play way too much Thrones.
Like, ideally, I want the surprise of being able to ambush stuff in, you know, take an icon, then bounce them to hand. I get a couple characters on the board and whatnot. But, you know, without an Arion, I'm looking at 5 gold to pull that. Or, sorry, 5 gold for the messenger and 4 here, 9 gold total. Oh, I mean, even with Arion for one of the two of them, it's still pretty expensive. So, I don't know. It might be doable on its own, but I almost think so more just for the stats.
Yeah, I think this is a one or two of maybe, like in that very specific type of deck. I just feel like that deck requires, like, awfully heavily requires Arion, right? Like, if you don't see Arion, you're going to have a severe problem.
Yeah, it's going to be real hard to afford all those tricks if you don't see her.
And in second edition, playing it doesn't count as enters play, right?
No, it does. If you you can marshal this and trigger it.
So could you marshal this? Does the other one have to enter play the same way? How does that work?
I think, isn't it... Let me go look it up. I think it has something to do with challenges, doesn't it? Or do I just think that because I always want to use it after my opponent has attacked?
I mean, that's a great way to use it, but like using that in marshaling if you're a second player.
I think the messenger, but this will show Aaron that I don't actually play that much Thrones. I think the messenger is when they enter during the challenges phase.
Yes. Yeah, I just pulled it up on ThronesDB. It's after Southron Messenger enters play during a challenge. So very specific.
That is annoyingly specific, yeah.
Yeah, and the what was the location? The green blood, was it? Or
The Prince's Pass, I think?
That definitely would do it.
That's that one also has to be challenge related.
After you lose a challenge.
Yeah.
Which is obnoxious. All right.
I mean, she's really good redundancy, though, for like an Arion-based icon control deck. You know, if you don't see the attachment... Or you know, you really do need to just get that one thing to make a Tears of Lyss go through, or make Tyene go through. Like, I think it's very, and she's not a bad card if you just have to marshal her. Like a 3-for-3, and her icon spread is good. I don't know. I think she's definitely better than the messenger.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? But the messenger's ambush cost is so high. It's even higher than this, isn't it?
Super high.
Yeah, I mean, it's one more. But, yeah, it's just, like, you're only ever using that with Arion, right? Like, neither one of these cards is at all efficient if you're not running Arion.
But I think she's fine. Like, if you just have to play a 3-for-3 Bicon as Claim Soak slash another, like, presence on the board, like, you're not sad about that. It's not like her one trick is her ability.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is I think I almost like that more than the ability, you know, just... efficiency from a stat perspective.
Definitely better than the 3-for-2 intrigue power. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
I don't know why this isn't a Sand Snake.
That would be nice. That would seriously make me really think about it. If I had the possibility of making it cheaper with Uller, then I would really think.
Or like just getting that extra icon with Nymeria, and I don't know. Is that all the sensing synergies we have? Probably.
This is probably setting up some sweet spy tech. I mean, Treat bloat is not going to be a thing. So I'm sure this is the beginning of something awesome.
Maybe we'll eventually get some kind of spy and companion agenda.
That would shake that stirred agenda?
Yes. All right.
If she had the bastard trait, she would go with the sand snake, the non-unique sand snake, right? Who, when bastardsly play, you discard a card from your opponent's hand at random.
It's just when it does.
Except for Nymeria right now.
Yeah, I'm looking up Martell cards, seeing if there's any others, but we can continue. So, yeah. Worth playing?
I think if I were to have to rate it right now, I'd probably give it an E. Man, nobody's going to comment on me throwing shade at Wama.
I think it's a C-plus card. I like the redundancy, though. So we don't know what's going to be in the Martell box, but we'll assume some icon stripping will be in the Martell box because that is one of their themes going all the way back to the core set. So
yes.
If they continue to get redundancy in this theme, she's just one more really useful and, in this case, an efficient character tool for more icon control. So I definitely expect to see her around, but I don't think she's going to fundamentally change like what Martell is doing, or she's not enough redundancy to make the icon stripping theme fully coherent yet, but certainly after maybe the Martell box or maybe what we see in the fourth cycle, we may be there to the point where there is a real honest to goodness icon stripping deck, and that's what that deck does, like the way in which Builders or the Martell Viper deck, you know, has that as its game plan.
Yeah, I think you're right. I fully expect once we have that Martell box in front of us that we will be revisiting the Dornish Spy for sure.
Gotcha. I mean, I think there's a lot there. I'm with Roy in that I think she's got some solid stuff going on. I think that on top of that, like being a solid character and like Roy says, like redundant, and if you get some more tech that lets you cheat in characters, which is not something, I mean, we've seen some of it out of Martell, so there's no reason to think that's not a theme you can expand on. I think her ability becomes even better.
All right, I've only read this twice while we were off air. So Locked Away is a 3-cost attachment. It is a condition attachment that is terminal. Reaction: after the marshalling phase begins, return attached character to its owner's hand cannot be saved.
Brilliant.
It has to survive the whole round, right?
Yeah, that delay is pretty big, I think.
But it cannot be saved. Bounce is pretty BA.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah, but it's at the beginning of the marshalling phase, right? So you bounce it, and then they can theoretically just remarshal the character. I mean, it's a big tempo hit, sort of.
Right.
It's a weird tempo hit.
A lot of gold.
It's different than any other Martell tempo hit yet.
Resets power counts on the character. That's nice stuff. But it's such a slow delay. And, I mean, think of all the attachment removal that can hit it before you come back around to the start of the next marshalling, you know?
You mean those,
Wildlings,
those three cards?
Saris. Well, you know, the ones that are played.
I mean, I feel like this card is really good in a, like, pre-heavy reset meta, but in a heavy reset meta, it's kind of useless. Like,
I don't know. It's a dupe stripper.
Yeah.
It does?
But, like, pre-Wildfire, like, sorry, not pre-Wildfire, pre-Valor, when we were just running pre-Valors, when we were just running three of everyone, and like, fuck your Wildfire, I don't care, you could just be like, well, and you didn't really have economy to just replay willy-nilly, unless you were Lannister. So, like, you would just be like, well, you don't have any gold plots left, I'm gonna stick this on Bob, and good luck ever getting him back on the board.
But wasn't just everyone always playing Confiscation at that point?
Like, yeah, but
and
like,
then they just flip that next turn.
Sure, then they flip that and you milk the character, and then they're milked forever, which was the problem with Confiscation, right?
Still is the problem with Confiscation.
Yeah.
Well, sure, sure.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think... Is it more powerful with Valor Doharis? It is, right? Because you can put it on their expensive character that they're going to save. Or
yeah.
Like save, I sense it's not count as, you know, count as.
Yes. Yeah, choose. You're going to choose.
Yeah, you're going to choose. And so popping that back up to their hand, that's where I think it's going to shine. I don't think it's particularly good in a Valor Mogulis meta.
I mean, at that point, you just choose to put that card to the bottom of your deck. This goes to your discard pile. And instead of it going to their hand, it goes to the bottom of their deck, right?
Yeah, but that's bad. That's way worse, right? Putting it in the bottom of your deck unless they're running deck manipulation. That's
I would sure think yeah. so.
Yeah, and the dupes are all being discarded. Yeah, no, that's valid. It's got its uses. I feel like if you're running this, you're probably running a lot of other attachments too, right?
Definitely.
Maybe? I don't know. A part of me could maybe see this in some kind of... along with some of the Bera discard stuff, you know, New Mel, or at least Seen in the Flames and such.
Oh, right.
To pop stuff back into their hand and then just discard it.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it can create some super solid moments, but you have to think about them and set them up. So, like, let's say, you know, you talked about it being devalued in a reset heavy meta. So, situations you commonly see in a reset heavy meta are smaller boards, pared down boards, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have one of these out and you play Marched, you are creating tough decisions for your opponent.
Right.
I mean, that's a moment I would love to be on the right side of. And theoretically an easy one to set up. And I mean, it's not like people usually regret running Marched as a plot anyways. So, like, I think this card has uses. You just have to look for them and be thinking, I mean... You'll like the card itself. You have to be looking a turn ahead when you play it. You can't just blindly stick it on a good guy. I mean, you can. I mean, bouncing a 7-coster is always going to be to your advantage, but the wins are not easy.
To build on that, like maybe a deck that's trying to do something political disaster-like where you are choking your opponent even after they're set up, where you can be you know, I put this on Tywin... And or Tywin, because well, I guess you wouldn't. It's a reaction, so you would already have counted the gold, right? But whatever, put it on Bob.
Well, if you go first,
put it on Bob. Put flip Valor or political disaster. Return Robert to your hand. Your opponent's like, oh, what the fuck are you gonna do now? Unless you're running a lot of economy plots. I think it's definitely, if you can find a way to destroy your opponent, because economy has gradually moved from the plots into the draw deck, you know, if you can find a way to leverage that, it's like, I'm going to return your best characters to your hand and destroy your economy base. That is really interesting thing to use this card as part of.
Yeah, this combos really, really well with Political Disaster.
Yeah, so fuck your Great Halls, or fuck your Red Keeps, then. Like, whatever, like, it really puts your opponent in a rough situation in a location-heavy meta where characters are really valuable.
Particularly. So, man, back when really Political Disaster came out, who expected we would later hear the phrase, man, this combos really well with Political Disaster?
I mean, I'm just going to make horrible jokes, and I decided not to.
Okay.
Let's move away from that and into, like, I feel like this is a really good Night's Watch card. Like, your Night's Watch aggro-y stuff would really like to just be like, hey, I don't want to deal with your 8-cost, your 7-cost dude, so go away. Or spend a turn playing him, and then I can, you know, work on other shit. It's just a really good slow down the tempo of the game.
Yeah. I mean, if we're already talking about, you know, the potential gold problems, any of that choky sort of stuff, the Watch has need or something.
Yeah. White
once
tree.
You send that character back to hand. Oh, you thought you could replay them this turn? You know, turn 3 on your last plot that would squeeze out enough gold? Nope, not anymore.
Yeah, I also now that I kind of like the political disaster control combo, but I also kind of dislike this card as a variance card because if a Martell player sees like a Dornish, is it Dornish Feed Them? Is that what the name of their economy?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Early and this early, and their opponent doesn't, and they put it, it's like, oh, okay, I have a decent character base. Be like, nope, put this on. I have the economy. You don't. Without even like political disaster, just you had a bad, I saw my economy first, you didn't. This is just like a card that could push variance even harder, which I don't like. If you see this early against an opponent that, you know, isn't able to get its economy set up, you know, that's like a fuck you card at that point.
And what's bad about, I mean, from a game design standpoint, I understand why that leaves some bitterness, but like as a player, like these are the moments that you think about and ways to use this card. I mean, I like it a lot. I think it's just, I think it scales with skill and familiarity. I think it's not something that you can just throw in a deck and it's going to rock for you. I mean, on some level, yeah, the easy play is five costers and higher, slap it on if you don't like it and you're done. But I think if you want to see this like really leverage and turn games, you have to A, prepare when you're deck building, and B, be looking for moments that you would not anticipate using it in.
Yeah.
You know, I just kind of want to draw some attention. I'm curious if this is a card that Nate slipped back into the design process and threw out there, since you know, second-ed players may not notice the, let's just say, very strong mirror to the old first ed locked in the tower. So, or sorry, was that CCG only and not in? Yeah, that was CCG.
Doesn't sound familiar to me.
Yeah, it's CCG.
Yeah. Sorry. The old, there was a Martell event that used influence or a noble crested character, three influence or noble crest to return someone to hand. So, you know, I see a connection here. So maybe Nate's sneaking a card in here and there.
Yeah.
This works really well to keep board small. This plus Venomous Blade equals like, you're always going to be under threat of being marched from Martell. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. They're getting some teeth now.
If only they had the reserve to hold this until it was good. That's what
reserve. I mean, Aaron, though, you're not making a good case for giving reserve to Martell, though, because if you know, if one of the few things that's holding them back, again, to go from a game design perspective, is the fact that they don't have high reserve, well, maybe we shouldn't give them reserve.
Well, from a game design perspective, assuming you would ever like them to be good, right? Like,
Sure, Martell's terrible right now, Aaron.
They are. Like, what tournaments are they winning?
Didn't they just win an Indy?
No, I don't think so.
Who run that? They were just runner up over in, where is it, Zaragoza? Somewhere? No.
I don't think they won anything. I thought they came in, like, they were making the cut a little bit, but, like, I mean, I guess if your goal for a house is to make the cut a little bit, sure, play Martell.
Yeah. Runner-up in Zaragoza.
Yeah.
There we go. There's that, at least. Past that, I'm not sure.
They made top 16 at Blackwater. That's really it. Unless they just didn't post the deck. Oh, yeah, Indy Regional winner.
Yeah, they won the Indy Regional. I was good. Thank you. I am not crazy. I was like, I know they won something pretty big.
I mean,
Indy had like 30 plus people, so
that's legit.
I would agree.
Yeah, it's a deck. It's a Varus Last of Giants deck.
God, Aaron, I forgot how much I mean, hated listening to your salty ass.
I almost forgot about that. That was one of our players.
It was one of your players that won? You didn't even know your own players winning?
What? No. I said they also had top 8 in Omaha.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Martell is in not as bad of a situation as Aaron's trying to make it out to be.
No, it is not.
I just feel like if Night's Watch defense is around, Martell is really hard to play.
That's true. This is a pretty crappy card against Martell, or excuse me, Night's Watch defense. Because it hits core. No, it doesn't hit core because it can't take attachments.
Yeah.
You know what's pretty bad up against Night's Watch defense? Basically every Martell card but Venomous Blade.
Blade's great, though.
Yeah, that's it. You better hit your blades.
Well, Blade can be really annoying when you're playing when you're playing as Night's Watch.
I'd assume the Saffron Messenger could be good against Night's Watch too.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it one of the silver bullet cards in the Night's Watch box? So
yes.
One could think that.
It's like almost like there was a plan. That.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Exciting. Good cards for Worlds. We'll see how Martell's going to be doing in that meta.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how it shapes up.
Martell loves Valor Doharis.
Does love VD.
I think this one's really good. I unlike Aaron, try really hard not to look for Predators in the meta because, I mean, they come as quickly as they go, but I really like this card. I'm very excited to build with this card.
I like the card, but I think that what you expect to see, like there was a while there where Night's Watch was like every second or third deck, and like if that's the meta you expect, you probably don't want to bring this. So it's going to depend where the meta is when this comes out. I think the Roy's Builders deck really, really loves Valor Doharis.
Does.
So, like, since it can just run Valor Doharis, like, if that deck gets a big boost and starts seeing much more play, then, I mean, like, this card won't be great for at least a little while.
Hey guys, quick preface before we get into the Martin interview. Wanted to give you guys a little bit of backstory. This is the first weekend that we had started to record the show. This was way back in 2011 at a con, the first Days of Ice and Fire, where FFG got George R. R. Martin actually to come down, do a couple panels, read a chapter from Feast for Crows before it was released, all sorts of fun stuff like that. It was recorded on a cell phone at a convention. So for anybody that does not enjoy the audio quality of the podcast these days, listen to this and tell me we haven't made some strides to try to improve things since then. So I do apologize. The audio is going to be awfully rough. We've tried to kind of fix it up as best we can, but it's still going to be there's some limitations on how good it can get. Now, this interview was actually done with myself, former co-host and two-time world champ Brett Zeiler, and a buddy of ours who played the game at the time named Paul, who actually co-hosted another podcast called Bear Swarm. So you will probably hear Bear Swarm mentioned in the podcast. We kind of let Paul lead things, maybe, you know, more than we should have because he was experienced with it, which let his show be mentioned more than ours, even though it was, you know, we outnumbered him and it was my asking FFG that actually secured the interview for us. So, you know, whatever. I'm not bitter. Paul, I hope you're listening to this and getting a good kick out of it. But regardless, I thought it might be interesting to folks that have picked up second edition or the podcast more recently and didn't realize that we did actually physically talk to George R. R. Martin many years ago. So here you go, guys. Enjoy the interview.
This is Paul from the Bear Swarm. We're here with George R. R. Martin just to kind of chat with him for a bit. Nothing too serious, just something for you guys to listen to. So we've been here in Minneapolis, the Days of Ice and Fire. He was the guest of honor. Okay, let's get it started. I'll go ahead and just start with a question about your characters. Obviously, I know writers tend to inject a bit of themselves in their characters. Well, you write what you know. Is there any particular character that you've maybe put a little more of yourself into?
You know, I mean, I'm often asked who is my favorite character, and the answer is usually Tyrion. So you could say that, although I'm significantly different from Tyrion in a lot of ways as well. But you're right. I mean, I think there's some of me in all of the characters, even the ones who seem on the surface to be utterly different from me, like the women or the hideous villains or the sorcerers or what have you. You know, in the existential sense here, the only one we ever really know inside and out is ourselves. So any writer who wants to do fully fleshed out three-dimensional characters has to dig deep, has to look inside to try to understand human motivations, hopefully tempered with a bit of empathy and a certain amount of imagination where you're saying, well, all right, what would it be like if I was an 8-year-old girl? What would it be like if I was an exile in a distant land? What would it be like if I was a dwarf? And try to put yourself, but you're still starting with yourself as the basis. But I also take inspiration from characters from friends and people in the news, you know, acquaintances, people I read about in history, things that they have done or said or perhaps written about themselves in autobiographies. All of that becomes grist for the mill.
Yeah. Conversely, there is there anyone that's particularly difficult for you to put yourself into their mindset and write about?
Well, the hardest character to write about is Bran, simply because he is the youngest character. He is the youngest. I have a number of children as characters, and Bran was the youngest of those that I've actually attempted to write about as a viewpoint thing. So I don't actually have any children, so I don't have any little examples running around my house to observe. I was a child once, but it was a long, long time ago, and I can try to remember what it was like. But when you're writing about a young child and you're inside his head, you really have to examine every word, every scene very, very carefully, because you have to ask yourself, well, would he see it that way? Would he understand, okay, he's present here and he's hearing these words. Does he understand these words? Does he understand what he's seeing? How does he perceive the world? You know, what level of sophistication is that? And you have to examine every sentence that way. And it's a tricky process. And with Bran, I don't want to spoil anything in the book, but, you know, at a certain point, he becomes severely limited in the actions he can take, and therefore there's a certain enforced passivity, too, that makes him more of an observer than an actor, and that's also a bit of a challenge. So Bran is the hardest character to write about, but I do find that rewarding, too, especially when I slog on through and get a good result.
Yeah, good. You had mentioned drawing upon historical figures for inspiration. And of course, you know, maybe it's just me, but I kind of see a lot of. I heard you mention, I believe yesterday, the British Wars of the Roses.
The Wars of the Roses, yes, that's certainly been one of the major influences, along with the Hundred Years' War, the Crusades, the Albigensian Crusade, you know, some other incidents and periods in history.
The Dothraki, what exactly did you have in mind for them? I kind of get kind of flashes of Mongolians, maybe even American Indians.
Yes, they are that. You know, I don't want to do with any of my I don't know, historical references. I don't like to do one-to-one things. I don't like to just take a figure from history and erase his name and give him a new fantasy name, but he's exactly the same as the figure from history, and he goes through the same things. I like to mix and match and sort of take, you know, you want the historical thing because it grounds you. It gives you something that'll help make it a little more gritty and realistic. But then you want to maybe take something from this character and something from that character and add a twist or an element of imagination, and you get a hopefully a new character who can be seen to be influenced by these historical figures, but is different. And that's certainly true with the Dothraki. I mean, many people have equated them with the Mongols of Genghis Khan and the Golden Horde and all that. And certainly there's a lot of that there, but they're not just the Mongols. They're significantly different from the Mongols in a number of ways, in their religion and in their level of technological sophistication in their history. I've also borrowed from them from certain of the other steppe peoples of the great Eurasian steppe, the Alans, who preceded the Mongols, the Huns, who were, of course, 1,000 years earlier. And then, as you say, the Amerindian tribes of the American plains, the Cheyenne and the Sioux. And to that, I've added a fantasy element. I've added some twists that was not true of any of those peoples, but is true of my Dothraki. So hopefully make them a people who are inspired by all of these things, but have their own fictional, fantastic identity.
Yeah. You were speaking yesterday during the Q&A a little bit about Arya's name and the kind of the qualities that you were looking for in that name, the kind of knife-like cutting sound. Right. There are other names in the series that are real-world names, Robert. There are others that are similar. Like you could almost see a descent or a corruption of names that we would normally hear, Eddard and things along those lines. Just you spend a lot of time working out heraldry and the like. Do you work a similar way with names, some of the related sounding ones like that?
Well, I've certainly spent a lot of time, you know, fiddling with the names and trying to get the names right. I do think names are important. If you have a name that rings false, it can take the reader out of the book. You know, there are several challenges here. The whole issue of names is a big one. I think I was talking yesterday about the sort of rule that they teach a lot of young writers in workshops and all that, where they tell you, well, you should never in a story have two characters whose name begins with the same letter, because the reader will get that confused as they're, you know, they're not reading aloud, they're just looking, they see an R, and so if you have a Robert and a Raymond, they may get them mixed up. Which is fine as far as this goes. It's a rule that I followed for many years in my short stories and then some of my other works. But then I start something like Ice and Fire, and of course I realize very quickly that I'm going to have more than 26 characters. So there goes that rule right there.
Yeah.
And the corollary to that rule is never have two characters who have the same name. That's even worse than beginning with the same letter. But again, reading history, I said, you know, people who study history don't seem to have any trouble telling Edward III first from Edward II, from Edward III, from Edward IV, etc. So why should fantasy readers be assumed to be more stupid than that? I think the history shows us that these names will be used, and it has a nice medieval ring to it. If you look at English history, it's all Edwards and Henrys and an occasional Richard sneaking in. And you look over to the French, and it's all. Louis and Phillips, etc. And that was also true of many of the noble families below the royal thing. They tended to use the same names over and over again. It was that sense of, this is our traditional family name, and I wanted that sense of tradition, so I did it that way. I also wanted the names to reflect, Westeros has a long and complicated history where it was originally, there was the non-human race, the children of the forest, and the first men came in, and then they built the civilization, and then the Andals crossed the border and pushed aside most of the first men, toppled most of their kingdoms. The Rhoynar came in just in the south, and latest of all, the Targaryens, who are descended from ancient Valyria. Each of these is a completely different cultural ethnic group. Each one would have a different pattern of names. So I tried to reflect that in in the names of the various families and all that. If you see a name like Stark or Strong or Mud, that's a first man. You know, their names are simple, descriptive kind of things. The Andal names tend to be more fanciful, like Arryn or Lannister. And then you get the Targaryens with their very long, complicated Valyrian names, frequently including Aes and Ys and that sort of thing. So I was going for all of that.
Interesting that you mentioned that about the northerly names, Stark and Mod and Strong and the like. I actually had an English professor talking about telling what words had descended from the German or the French influences or Latinate by the number of syllables. Not you know, a hard and fast rule, but it's interesting. I hadn't made that connection there with the naming scheme in your books.
I try to avoid names. You know, I have used some names. You know, sometimes I take a real life name like Robert, and I twist it with Robert, like Robert Glover, R-O-B-E-T-T. But sometimes I spell it the normal way, like Robert Baratheon. They're slightly different forms of the same name. I mean, if you look at the real life Middle Ages, they weren't really consistent on the whole idea of spelling. You know, we have like 7 examples of William Shakespeare's signature, and every one he spells it differently. I tried to have a little fun with that, reflecting that there. I got into an argument about this once at a convention where I was talking about this very naming issue with a woman who was a linguist and at a local university. And I said, you know, I tried to use any names that have that ethnic connotation, you know, because if you name someone Pierre, you automatically think French. And we have no French people in this world. It's, you know, it's an imaginary world. There's no country called France. And she said, well, but you violated that because you have Roberts and these names also have ethnic origins. And that's true, of course. Technically, she's right. But I think effectively she's wrong, because I think for modern American readers and British readers, we tend to think of Robert, and we don't think of them as ethnic names. We think of them as, I don't know, the default names of our culture, Robert and Edward and Richard and things like that. So you use those names, and they don't evoke any particular ethnic group that leaps out. Like if you name someone Guido, and they say, well, does this Italian wander into this fantasy? But it's difficult, actually. And especially a book as big as A Song of Ice and Fire, because I chew up names by the cartload. There are so many characters, so many secondary and tertiary characters, and they all need names.
Yeah.
So I'm always having to think of another one, and sometimes I get one that just doesn't ring right, you know, and I pick at it like something caught between your teeth, you know. I got the name in there, and I'm working on the book, and yet every time I come on that character, something bothers me about it, and finally I come up with something different and substitute it.
I have a question about my favorite, not even tertiary character.
I'm glad you are. Yeah.
I wondered. Dick and Man Woody. Was that on purpose?
You know, it's been so long ago. I came across that name somewhere. I don't remember where now. Man Woody. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dickon, of course, was a common Middle Ages nickname or variant for Richard. Dickon, Rickon. There were things like that. But I don't know where I encountered the name Man Woody, but it just seemed cool. So
yeah,
I threw it in there.
Yeah, they have a very impressive house, like their heraldry, and their castle is called Kingsgrave,
right.
And then Dick and Man Woody.
you can't hear that name and not laugh.
Yeah.
There are some of the names of the minor characters who are my homages to other fantasy writers, mm-hmm. who are the people that I admire. They're not going to be major characters. They're sort of background characters. But there's actually two branches of House Vance, you know, which is my tip of the hat to Jack Vance, one of the great fantasists of our time and science fiction writers of our time, whose work has been tremendously influential on, I think, not just me, but a whole generation of science fiction and fantasy writers. And similarly, there's a House Rogers, which is for my friend Rogers, the late Roger Slazny, and there's a House Jourdain of Detour, which is for my friend Robert Jourdain. And you know, they're just background things, but it's just my way of nodding to some fellow fantasists.
We actually very big fans of the games that have been based out of your imagination, I suppose. Currently play the Song of Ice and Fire role playing game twice weekly,
The new one from Green Ronin, the old one from Guardians of Water?
The new one from Green Ronin right now, although the old version is probably the best-looking role-playing game book I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's very impressive.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's a shame that they went bankrupt and began publishing it.
I actually have a copy of the older book. Couldn't find anybody to play that version with me, but yeah, the new version we enjoy immensely. How much input, you know, obviously when somebody is using your creative or your intellectual property and you know, kind of tinkering around with it, obviously weird things can happen, but how much kind of direct input do you have in these things?
Well, you know, I have some. All of my contracts for secondary rights contain certain approval clauses. The question is, to what extent do I exercise the approval? Now, in the case of games, I tend to let the games company do, you know, whatever they want with the rules and all that. I'm not, although I have games and I have been a gamer and I've enjoyed various kinds of games, from board games to role-playing games, whatever. I am not an expert on game design or anything like that, so I leave that to the expert. They can design, you know, what they call the crunchy bits, I guess.
Yeah.
I want to have a certain amount of review and approval of the text and the stuff you're saying about the world, and particularly of the art. That being said, I really have had to pull back since the early days. You know, I mean, we're doing this here at Fantasy Flight's Wonderful Days of Ice and Fire, and Fantasy Flight has done some of the best games of the things. They're collectible card game and board game and the new living card game. And the card games in particular generated an enormous amount of art.
Yeah.
And when we first started this, you know, they were sending me every card and I was reviewing every card and I was writing like paragraph long critiques of every card. And it was great, but, you know, I know this world so well that I'm sure I was driving the poor guys at Fantasy Flight crazy with, you know, my nitpicking, you know, no, he has the shade of color of his cloak is not quite right. And, you know, these buttons on his jacket, I don't like them. And, you know, that kind of thing is too fussy. And not only that, it was eating up so much of my time. I realized after a few months of this that this way lay madness both for them and for me. So I pulled back, and I don't review any of the generic cards anymore. The ones that are just like Treachery or, you know, the Rose Road or a Merchant Ship, that kind of card. The ones that particularly show my characters or scenes or castles, I do try to review. Even then, between Green Ronin and Fantasy Flight and my other licensees from out of the games area, like the Dark Sword Miniatures or the Valerian Steel Replica Weapons, the Valerian Resin Mini Busts, there's a lot of stuff to review, and sometimes it's very hard for me to keep up and write these books at the same time. So I'm really kind of torn on this point. I like to be part of the process. I like to guarantee that to the extent that I can, that the products that come out really reflect the world of Westeros and will not be a disappointment. I don't want to be one of these guys who just sells the license and cashes the check. But I can't be. If I was involved to the extent that I want to be, I'd never get any writing done. And as you know, I'm kind of late already. So I don't know. I try to do the best I can in that regard.
All right. And a listener of the show wanted me to ask this question to you as well. If Jerry Jones were a Westeros character, owner of the Cowboys, obviously.
The spy is Jerry Jones. You can't tell me any football scores, though. I've been away traveling. I've keyboarded all the game. I don't know anything has happened in the last four.
Yeah, I've been keeping track of the scores. I was going to ask you after the interview if you were interested.
No. No, you must keep them all secret so I can. I'm going to go home and I'm going to watch all my games on TiVo. So a month worth of Giants and Jets games.
Yeah.
But Jerry Jones is scum. So I don't know who would be. The appropriately scummy person to be in Westeros.
I kind of thought Walter Fry. that was kind of my natural inclination.
I could see that. Yeah.
Well, connected, I guess, to the art, O'Kane, and like, I know you said you're kind of limited in what you can say about the HBO series, but hopefully this is something you can say a little on. I'm thinking you likely had a similar okay on the actors, and if so,
no, you're wrong about that. You're dealing with a different order of magnitude when you're dealing with Hollywood. Unless you're J.K. Rowling, no one gets approval. That's usually a deal killer. If you can get it, if you're J.K. Rowling, but maybe for Stephen King, but not for anything short of that. And as well as my books do, I'm not at that level yet. So I had a consultation. I viewed all of the auditions. I put in my 2 cents worth on the actors, but I don't have any kind of veto power or approval on the actors or the set design or anything like that. I'm just one voice among many saying, well, this is my thought. This is, I like this actor. I didn't like this one, et cetera. And sometimes they listen and sometimes they don't. And, there are a dozen other people whose voices are just as important as mine in the complicated process of putting together a television series.
Yeah. Anything that you're particularly excited about? Just kind of a general question. It doesn't necessarily have to, be the HBO series.
Well, I am excited about the HBO series. That's one of the big things. And I've just returned from visiting the sets in Malta and in Belfast, Northern Ireland, where we have our principal soundstage. And I've watched some of the filming, and it's seen some of the rough footage, and as far as I can tell, it's going great. So, we have a few more months till hopefully that debuts, and that's exciting. And I'm also excited about the fact that I'm almost, I hope, finished with this damn book that I've been writing, since the dawn of time. And it will be very nice to get that gigantic monkey off my back, mm-hmm. and hopefully turn in a book that the readers will enjoy. Although, of course, I know already with a grim foreknowledge that I will turn in a book and it will be published. And the day it comes out, I will get the first email saying, when's the next one coming? that's what's waiting for me. I'm not naive about that. So.
Yeah, I said, with your books, I was a senior in high school when I read Game of Thrones back in 96, I think.
Yep.
And I have been following it ever since. When I found out there was a card game, I was like, oh, what? You mean I can use these characters? And it just kind of it steamrolled into that. How much kind of the reverse have you seen? People getting into the card game or into the role-playing game and realizing, oh, wow. This is huge. And
well, I think there's some. I have no hard statistics, but I think that's one of the cool things about doing these sub licenses, is that you get this kind of synchronicity where people encounter the card game first, or the board game, or the miniatures, or whatever, and they think it's cool, and then they start picking up the books. Mark, you might know more about that than I do. Do you have any knowledge of how many people start with the games and go on to the books?
Only a personal anecdote, and me, but no hard statistics, I'm afraid, no.
You know, when I first started getting these offers for sub rights, for card games and for board games and, you know, for other spin-off products like that, I was really of two minds about whether to accept any of them. Because, on the one hand, you know, I'm kind of a geek, and I was all thrilled by the idea of having little miniatures, my characters, and having these games and all of that stuff. But then there's another part of me that's a pretentious, serious artist, and I was saying, well, wait a minute, is this cheap merchandising? I'm trying to work a work of literature here that would be, you know, hopefully stand the test of time, and it's probably my magnum opus. Do I want to commercialize it here? You know, what would F. Scott Fitzgerald would never have, sold these rights and all that. But then I actually thought about it for a while. I said, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald never got an offer. I bet you, knowing F. Scott, if someone had come to him and said, we want to do Great Gatsby action figures, he would have signed at the moment. He and Zelda would have gone on another jolly vacation to Paris or whatever. So I decided to go ahead and not worry about it. But I do think it has worked out well because it brings people to the books, and the books bring people to games, and everything brings people to everything else. And hopefully the HBO series will bring people to the games and the books and the miniatures and the whole shebang.
Yeah. You're obviously one of the real big, great fantasy authors of our time. You know, you're like even Robert Jordan. I don't know if you've ever met like some of the newcomers, like Brandon Sanderson, people like that. What's your opinion on just like the new guard of fantasy authors, I guess?
I've met, I go to science fiction conventions regularly and have since the 1970s, Worldcon in particular, and then various regional conventions every year. So the science fiction fantasy writers form a community, and we kind of all know each other for the most part, as long as you go to conventions. There are a few who don't, but so yeah, I know I've met Brandon Sanderson. I know Joe Abercrombie. Daniel Abraham is a good friend of mine. I've met Scott Lynch. Some of the others I haven't met, but I've exchanged an occasional email with. This is a great time for fantasy, I think. There's tons of terrific new fantasy coming out. There's also tons of not-so-terrific new fantasy coming out, but that's always been the case, you know. It's Sturgeon's Fall, so you have to find the good writers among the less good writers. But epic fantasy is riding high. And I think there's some terrific new people coming out right now. I think Joe Abercrombie is really first rate. Scott Lynch, his Lies of Loch Lomora was a terrific thing. And Daniel Abraham, who completed his Long Prize Quartet four-volume series. I think he did the entire four books while I've been struggling with this one book, goddamn him. And now he's launched on a new series called The Dagger and the Coin, which I think is, I've read the first book of that, and it's going to be a sock flopper. It's a terrific series.
I actually haven't read him. Thank you for the recommendation. I'll go check it out.
Same.
Speaking of...
One more.
Okay. Speaking of some of these other authors, and you mentioned, the wide variety of things that you've read over the years, I'm sure a certain amount of bleed or cool ideas come back and forth, but has there been anything as you've been writing that you've kind of gone, wait a minute, this is something that happened in book X that I read, maybe I ought to, pass and or change that?
I'm not sure you're...
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm getting my question across there.
I think it was one where like if there's like a scene or a character that you have maybe inadvertently drawn inspiration from other works.
Yeah, yes. A certain amount of that, I assume, just kind of happened organically because, you know, you're exposed to other things.
To my knowledge, I don't take anything from other people's fantasies. I do plunder freely from history. I'm constantly reading popular histories, and, you know, my lady Paris is a... I'm always looking up and saying, you can't make this stuff up. And I find some incident or some anecdote that's just so incredibly visceral and vivid that, you know, it's just amazing. And I included in my book. But I usually, once again, change it. I mean, the most conspicuous example, I won't go into details, but there's an incident in the third book called The Red Wedding, which is very loosely inspired by a real incident in Scottish history called the Black Dinner. But if you read about the Black Dinner and you read about my Red Wedding, you'll see they're very different, but the Black Dinner inspired Red Wedding. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. That's fair. Wonderful. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So, well, Will transitioned us to props and slops. So
yeah, we might as well retransition that real quick. How about props and slops?
All right, here we go. Prop to Will for getting through 300 semi-consecutive episodes of The White Book.
I'm glad you threw it semi-consecutive.
/ 2C1C. The champ. You are the chump in 2C1C, but the champion of our heart, Will.
You've said that so many times, and it's corny every single time.
It's amazing.
You know,
we all
but
love
I love it.
It
every single time. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome.
You mean
I mean,
so
it says a lot. In a world where, I mean, how many podcasts have come and gone, and this one has sustained, I mean, almost purely on Will's back.
I don't think you said that the right way, Kyle. I'm pretty sure it's supposed
no,
to
No, you were definitely
in
on someone's back.
In a world where podcasts come and go. One show remained. You know, like that.
So
like that.
I will bet anyone that the show outlasts banter.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That sounds like fighting words. I mean,
that, what
I
that
agree,
means is that Bamford is going to just be recording 5-minute episodes in his bathroom until, you know, the show will be dead. The game will be dead, and we'll have turned this into like an L5R podcast, and Bamford will still be, you know, just chugging away.
Wait, I thought
5-minute episodes, all I gotta do is...
Wait. I thought that's what banter did now.
Damn.
Well, there's 5 minutes so of content. Shit. The episodes are a lot longer.
Beyond the Wall is gone. I need to shit talk somebody.
Yeah, well, at least we know our friends across the pond are fans of shit talking, right?
That's true. They're gonna fire back, though. None of that Canadian politeness anymore.
They will.
The whole reason I started shit-talking Beyond the Walls is because they kept shit-talking us and Will was too classy to ever reply.
Truth.
I am not too classy to ever reply.
I did, you know, because Alex did put over the last episode of Beyond the Wall, the introduction, which was like really polite shade against this entire show. So
what's it?
We're going to be a focused podcast. We're going to talk about the international community.
Yeah.
We're going to have editing.
Well, okay, maybe the editing part, but, you know, everybody's got to have their niche.
Yeah, we entertain.
We have the fun co-hosts.
Hey,
they have editing.
You know. You know what Beyond the Wall's niche is? Being dead.
Oh.
Hold on. They're not the only dead podcast. We've also got Summer is Coming.
I mean,
Inside and Down.
This is Game of Thrones. We should be careful.
Brotherhood Without Manners.
This is the podcast that was promised, and the army of dead podcasts are marching at our walls.
Oh, the podcast that was promised.
We are
Man,
basically
that needs
God's
to be
spell,
our tagline,
right? Because we died and we're reborn.
Yeah.
Spoilers. Ooh, with a new name.
Yeah.
And then all those poor dead podcasts can keep marching at us and slamming into the wall, falling apart.
Man, I just want to like rush and do us all t-shirts for Gen Con proclaiming the podcast that was promised.
Please do that.
That sounds great.
The third edition, that'll be the name of the podcast.
Yeah. We'll be sitting here at episode 400.
Game of Thrones, the dice game, the podcast that was promised.
Oh, we know that's coming, right? Okay. Like, it's got to be a point.
I think I discussed that on Second Sons, but FFG hating money is the only reason that doesn't exist.
That's true. That's true. I don't know why.
Hey, Second Sun still kind of exists.
Yeah, you guys came back to life, so well done. Yeah. You are reborn.
So, hey, props to the third longest running Game of Thrones podcast, too.
That's pretty impressive that you guys are now like the third longest running living podcast.
And we've done a whole like six episodes ever, so it's really great. I'm amazed Roy's not correcting me.
Yeah, well, you know, he probably has more productive things to do. Okay, so what else do we have props and slops wise? I'm going to throw some props, honestly, to our listeners, because if there weren't folks listening to the show, and preferably ones providing feedback about our topics, then I just don't think I would have put up with it for 300 episodes. That is a long time to do something without folks, enjoying it and listening to it. So thank you to the listeners for making it worthwhile.
I want to prop George R. R. Martin for being such a slow fucking writer that, like, if he finished this in a timely manner, podcasts wouldn't have even really existed yet. And then none of this would have ever happened.
Still talked about the book, or sorry, about the game instead of the books, right?
I don't know. Would there have even been a game? Like, if this finished in 4 years, it might have just been forgotten. It's like that it's taken 25 fucking years, is why, 30 years?
Too long.
25.
Way too long.
I don't know how to do math, so a long time.
It hurts so bad.
But it got us 300 episodes of the podcast that was promised.
It did, and so hopefully another 100, maybe two. Granted, I think even like being on early, like we never would have imagined 300. Like this was a moonshot to begin with.
Yeah, when the show started, the concept of hitting 300 episodes would not have entered my mind. It's kind of mind-boggling to think about. But, on the other hand, now that you mentioned another 200 episodes, man, hitting 500 sounds
impossible. Doable,
sort of, from a number perspective, until I think that's four more years.
Holy shit. This game cannot, maybe, but, I'd be
amazed. You'd be at almost a 10-year anniversary at that point. It'll be here in 4 years, Glazer.
Might as well just
I don't know if it'll be good. Let me rephrase this. I'll be meeting up in various parts of the country to get really drunk 5 or 6 times a year in 4 years.
But I found I don't need the cards for that.
It's a nice precursor. It makes the wives feel better.
It really does. It's a great excuse. I'm going to Dark Nodges for this weekend. Gonna go drink and supposedly play cards.
Yeah. So, the cards are the cover.
I'm going to sleep in a bed with Roy. It's going to be adorable. I just feel like the listeners should know that. Props to that, because Roy's gone and can't refute me.
Huge props to that.
I think deep down, Roy's the big spoon.
It depends if the spoon is sopping up vegetables or meat.
I don't know how to respond to that.
It's probably best you don't. It would have got real dirty real fast. Can I prop a real thing?
Sure.
Not that the podcast isn't, but the random Roy shit talk wasn't. I want to prop Nerdwriter. It's a YouTube series of visual essays. They're phenomenal. Like, everyone I've showed gets completely hooked and watches like 15 in a row.
Oh, nice.
It breaks down the language used to tell in movies, TV shows, so on and so forth. There's a How Louis C.K. Tells a Joke. There's a Problem with Batman vs. Superman one. It's really, really excellent.
Wow.
High quality
stuff. How do you even like make it through the problems in Batman versus Superman?
6-minute video, and it nails it really fucking well. Check
Jeez.
It out.
Huh. Okay.
I've been watching a series on YouTube called Thug Notes. My wife reads a lot and allows me to pretend to be well-read and educated.
Huh.
And I really like that for minimum effort.
Yeah.
And charming pictures.
That's what life's all about.
Yeah. The American theory. Props to Doctor Who for the female doctor.
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped. I really liked her on Broadchurch. Oh, happens to be the only other thing
I need to
watch
that.
Her in. But I think she'll be very good and interesting.
I haven't fallen in love at all with Capaldi. I like him, but I feel like it's all the stuff that's happening with him. I mean, I'm still only halfway through this last season. But like, I feel like everything is very plot-driven instead of his doctor-driven. And I don't know. Like, that's not what I want from a doctor. So I'm ready for a change. And I like the idea of a different kind of change. Not just, you know, not just another white guy. Like, let's try a woman. What's the worst that could happen?
I mean, I just want somebody, like, charming. That's really all I want out of the doctor, you know?
Yeah. Charming and a little different. Because, like, I like when they feel different. Like, Tennant and Smith felt super different immediately.
Yeah, I greatly enjoyed both of their runs. But I think I chalk a lot of that, personally, up to that charm. Like, I was willing to just go along with a lot, where I was a little less willing to go along with that from Capaldi or... why did my brain shut down now?
Yeah,
on
I don't
nine?
Know the first guy's name either, but I don't like him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the only one I actually don't like.
Eccleston.
Like,
Eccleston.
Yeah, I actively didn't like Eccleston. He just wasn't, like, he was too serious. It
yeah, it's not his kind of role. He's great in other stuff I've seen, but the Doctor was not his kind of role.
Mm-hmm. We are in complete agreement. Which well, never happens, so we should really call it a day.
Like, that, you know, I feel a little worried about that. I'm afraid we might have accidentally stepped into the...
Danger Zone!
Yes! Classic! And that truly closes our chat. As well, I wanted to take a second here in the Easter egg for anybody that's listened this far to announce a new podcast I'm doing titled The Things I Do for Love. I finally decided to get off my duff and fill a niche in the Thrones community that I think had been lacking, and that is for very short form Thrones content. So the goal of The Things I Do for Love is to run about 10 minutes. We're going to kind of tinker around, play with the format, see what we can and can't do with it. And right now, it looks like Mondays are going to be the release day for that. So we've got one coming up this Monday following the release of the White Book episode 300. So let me know what you think of The Things I Do for Love.